40% chance of rain. Today's high, 89. The heat index approaching 100 this afternoon. Right now, wind from the west at 9. Humidity, 82%. 76 degrees in Racine. 77 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, now offering the Sports Management Master's Degree Program. Students learn the business skills necessary to succeed in today's competitive sports environment. Flexible degrees for in-demand careers. More at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm delighted to have with me on the morning show for her very first visit to the program, Dr. Angela Dasso, who is Assistant Professor of Biology at Carthage College. The reason for this invitation is kind of interesting. Somebody from Carthage contacted me to see if WGTD could be of assistance to Professor Dasso, who at that point I don't think I'd ever met, who had to record something for some sort of academic organization or journal or something, podcast, I think. And they really needed a very good audio recording made, and could that be done here at the station? And of course, I was happy to oblige, and that was my chance to meet Professor Dasso for the first time and learn at least a little bit of the really fascinating research that she has been engaged in over the last few years. And so this is the tangible way she's thanking us for our technical assistance with this recording. She is our morning show guest today to talk about the research that she does, primarily in the area of animal vocalization, that is, the sounds that animals make. And in some cases, what she is studying is, what are those animals saying? What do the sounds they make represent? In other cases, what she is studying is how the vocalization of a given animal, I mean, not a species, but an exact one gray wolf, for instance, how is that gray wolf's vocalization different from another gray wolf who just lives in the next forest over or whatever? And what are the details of the sounds that they make that offer that kind of differentiation and make each wolf's own song or vocalization unique? And there's even research into the vocalization of turtles, believe it or not. Who even knew that turtles make sounds? Well, they do. And we're just beginning to understand the vocalization of turtles and why they say what they say. So we have a lot to talk about, and I could not be more excited to welcome Dr. Angela Dasso to the morning show. We welcome you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very, very excited about this. We have tons to talk about, but I do want to make sure that since this is your first visit to the morning show, that we give our listeners some sense of who you are and where you come from and so on. Give us a little bit of biographical background, if you would.
I was born in central Wisconsin around the Wausau area, and then I came to Madison for college for an undergraduate degree, where I was there getting degrees in wildlife ecology and entomology. Worked at a museum there for several years, actually. I was there for 10 years working at the Zoology Museum, doing preparator work, so essentially taxidermy work for a large museum, and then I went to grad school there. So I've stayed in Wisconsin more or less my whole life, but I love to travel. There's not a single place in this world I would not want to go to. It is
passion. Right, and it sounds like your research is taking you into some very, very interesting places. I'd love to hear a little bit about what in your background specifically got you so fired up in the natural world around you. I mean, were you kind of growing up in kind of a rural setting of sorts, or is there some other reason why this interest was ignited so ferociously for you?
Right. I did grow up in a rural setting, but I also participated in a high school independent study with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, where I was tracking wolves and also radio tagging turtles. And so I spent a lot of time outdoors just working with these really fun animals to trap and track. And so when I went to school to turn my undergraduate degrees, I thought, well, you know, this is something that I think I would like to continue doing. So I got my start early on just being mentored by some really wonderful people in the DNR. And then I sort of developed this into my own research as they continued. And the turtle part of the work has always been around for me, even though it hasn't been the primary species that I work with. The primary species I work with actually is in Thailand. It's the white-handed gibbon. They're lesser apes. So the main difference between an ape and a monkey is that apes do not have tails. Monkeys do. And apes have larger brains than monkeys. So the complexity of sounds that they can make is a little bit greater. And that was of interest to me because I was really kind of focused on what are these animals saying, as you mentioned already.
Right. So. And it's fascinating work. And as we've already kind of touched on, there's actually several different kinds of animals that you have done research into. And we'll explore all of them. Before we're done, we should make clear to people that you you started at Carthage several years ago, and actually started as kind of a visiting professor, and of course it's evolved then into to a tenure track position. How did that invitation come to you for that visiting professorship?
The visiting professorship was something I just found on a job posting online, and I knew another professor who was at Carthage already, so I'd contacted her to find out, you know, how does she like being here? She came also from UW-Madison, which, of course, is a very large college. Very different dynamic in the classroom, but I was really more interested in the kind of dynamic that's at Carthage, where we have small classes, we get to know our students really well. I love that. So I was kind of searching for liberal arts colleges, and Carthage came up, just happened to be at the right time.
Right. Well, and you began teaching at Carthage pretty much the same time that the beautifully refurbished Straws Center for Science
That did not hurt things.
Yes,
I did happen to come just as that building was being finished. So
fantastic.
Good timing all around.
Absolutely. Tell our listeners what you teach at Carthage.
So I teach The introductory biology courses, things like population systems and organisms, this would be a first or second semester biology course. And then I teach our ecology-based courses, so introductory ecology, advanced ecology. I'm a very, very big fan of reptiles and amphibians. So last semester when I taught advanced ecology, I had it focused on herpetology, which is the just specific to those two groups. But then I'm also teaching entomology. All insects.
All right.
I also love insects. Right. You anything animal based.
So you like insects and you like the reptiles that eat them and the amphibians that eat them. Very good. Before we dig into the specifics of your fascinating research, I would love to have you kind of explain a little bit about the sort of the dual nature of teaching and doing research, which is, of course, both important elements in what you do at Carthage. How do those things get balanced? And to what extent is the research you do folded into your academic responsibilities and academic load? Or is that something that you simply have to find time to do on top of all of your teaching responsibilities? I honestly don't know in your wing of the college exactly how that works.
Right. Well, it is a little bit of both. So I have 7 students in my lab. They sign up for research credits with me, and I treat it like I'm teaching another class. So I have it kind of set up where we have these kind of formal meetings. We have formal times that the students are working on their own, times that they kind of bring me up to speed as to what they're doing. I can help guide them along the way. So I treat it a lot like teaching an extra class each semester. But then I also spend a lot of time off campus working on my research as well. I just got back from a conference at the University of Tennessee at the National Institute of Mathematical and Biological Synthesis, or NIMBUS. It's a workshop where they brought a group of bioacousticians together, most for cetacean researchers, so whales and dolphins, which is really fascinating in its own right. We were just there working on our own bioacoustics research and putting together kind of summary articles of where the field needs to go. So I spend a lot of time outside or off campus working on my research, but I like to have a little bit of time just carved away for the students specifically to make sure that they're getting the mentoring that they need and they're getting a good head start on going to grad school.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
For those of you just joining us, my guest on the morning show today is Dr. Angela Dasso, who is assistant professor of biology at Carthage, and the primary area of her research is in the vocalization of animals. And very specifically, she has explored the vocalization of gray wolves, of the white-handed gibbon, and of certain turtles. And I think it would be interesting, Professor Dasso, if we take our listeners back to 2006, which I think is when you first became interested in the vocalization of animals. I think ahead of that, probably you were interested in that to the extent that most of us, you know, kind of are intrigued by that. But you got really serious about it in 2006. Tell us where you were when you first were sort of introduced to how fascinating an area this would be to research.
Yeah, I was living in the Amazon rainforest in Brazil. So I was there actually for 4 months the first time I was down there. Beautiful area, no electricity, no running water. It's a very rough environment, not for everyone, but I loved it. And I was actually down there working with the freshwater river turtles in terms of the hatchlings, looking at whether the sex ratios of those hatchlings vary in different temperature regimes. And I just happened to be lucky enough to be there at the same time that a bioacoustics researcher was down there studying turtle vocalizations. And so I helped her actually make some of the first recordings of freshwater river turtles in the world. And it was a really fascinating idea to me that turtles are actually communicating with one another vocally. We just didn't know that before. We thought most of the communication was all visual based or tactile based, touching one another. But yeah. As it turns out, now we've discovered even more species are vocalizing.
Wow.
And those turtles that are in Brazil, there was a follow-up study done with them, and they found that the females actually hang out by the nests, and they will vocalize to their offspring and call their offspring into the water when it's time to move upstream.
Wow. You were mentioning when you were describing the work that this woman was doing that in some respects the Amazon is a terrible place to study something like this because the Amazon River itself is so loud. And so the task of discerning what sounds are being made by the creatures there is much, much more difficult than it would be in some other sort of pristine, idyllic setting where you wouldn't have that roar of this mighty river in the background.
Right. Water is a fantastic medium for transmitting sound waves, but the problem in the Amazon is that there are so many species in that river that are vocalizing that we just don't know, you know, when we were first recording, which sounds belong to which animals. There's two species of freshwater dolphins that are in that river vocalizing. There's dozens of species of fish that are grinding teeth or producing sounds through their swim bladders. And then there's all these different turtles.
So I kind of misunderstood you. I was just thinking, well, you have this loud river in the background. It isn't that so much. It's that there's this plethora of creatures that vocalize.
It is the plethora of creatures,
yes. Okay. And then in the midst of that is what I assume is a fairly modest sound in terms of decibels being produced by these turtles.
Right.
And so trying to clarify the sound that they are making. Explain how that process goes in terms of determining that once and for all. I think if I remember correctly, it involves taking those turtles into a place where you can really listen to them in isolation.
Right. So similar to what you helped me with last week in recording, we have to do the same thing with our turtles. We have to take them, or any other animal, we have to take them out of their environment, put them in a soundproof room or as quiet of a room as possible, and record them isolated from other individuals for just a short period of time. It doesn't affect their behavior at all. But that allows us to understand what the bass vocalizations are. So then we can go back into those noisy systems and say, oh, this voice belongs to this species.
Hmm. So in general, what do we know about the vocalization of at least those species of turtles that have been studied? First of all, this is a sound that we can just hear with our own human ears. It's not a sound that requires special equipment to even detect.
No. So when you're recording in the water, you have to obviously have a hydrophone, which is basically a waterproof microphone. But aside from that, you know, they vocalize in the same frequency range that humans vocalize. They get a little bit higher in frequency than what most humans can vocalize. But they're something that you can actually hear.
And what does it sound like?
They make whoos. They're
really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yes.
Huh. And is it a wide range? I mean, sort of a wide palette of different sounds that they make? I mean, all related to that?
It's very species dependent. So the snake-neck turtle in Australia, which was actually the first species that was published on, they make 17 different types of sounds. So English speakers will make anywhere from 40 to 44 different types of sounds. We call them phonemes.
Mm-hmm.
But for these turtles, they were making 17 different types
wow.
of sounds.
Wow.
We wouldn't refer to them as phonemes for the turtles, but they're the basic units of sound. And for that species in Australia, they make a lot of chirping type sounds in addition to the whoos.
And where are we in our research in the field in general in terms of really understanding, for instance, what is being said? I mean, with these different combinations of sounds, are we to the point yet where we know very much about that?
It's really species dependent. So for our turtles, since this is such new research, we really only have one study so far that has demonstrated parental care in a meaning. But for other species, like the gibbons that I work with, one of the things that McClebber and I discovered is that they do have word-like structures for when there's different predators around. So when there's a clouded leopard versus a tiger versus a snake, they have different sequences of sounds that they will use to identify those different threats.
Wow.
And some of the work that I had done in grad school was also comparing that with our captive population. So we have two white-handed gibbons at the Racine Zoo, and then there's two at the Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison. And I was working with both of those zoos and recording their two gibbons at each zoo respectively, and discovered that they the captive gibbons also have a word for their veterinarian.
Ah.
They do not like whenever the vet comes by, they have a warning.
Wow. So
very
produce. Wow.
And then the Henry Vilas Zoo actually got even a little bit funnier in that when the Goodyear blimp comes by, they have a different warning for that.
Really?
Right.
Wow.
What they perceive as a threat varies, huh. Yeah.
So all these conversations going on that we just had no idea were going on. I mean, we obviously for a long time have known that something like this white-handed gibbon made all kinds of sounds.
Right.
But, now we're getting to the point, thanks to your research, to actually be able to understand some of the specifics of what they're saying.
Right. And prairie dogs, I don't work with prairie dogs, but some of the other researchers who work with them also discovered that they can identify different colors in addition to predators. So
wow,
there's a lot that is going on in the bioacoustics field.
Wow. Fascinating. I want to go back to turtles for a moment because you were telling me about a project that you are working on right now that sounds particularly exciting, related to the study of specifically hatchling turtles. So describe to our listeners the device that you are in the midst of constructing.
Right. So I'm going to take a step back further from that and just describe why this is necessary first.
Yes.
Okay. But the big issue here is that when turtles hatch out of their nests, they're too small to put radio transmitters on. So the hatchlings leave the nest and then they disappear. We really don't know where they go until they're adults. And so to be able to record them, the first problem is to figure out how do we keep track of them. Since we can't use the traditional techniques of radio transmitters, that well, perhaps we can employ some new technology to be able to track them. And so I came up with this idea that we could use an underwater autonomous vehicle, or basically a robot, to track these turtles, where we'd put tags on the turtles, a pit tag on the turtle, which is smaller than a radio transmitter, and then send this little turtle robot, they call them, after the turtles. So it would essentially follow where the turtle is going in the pond or river system. And then it would have a hydrophone also attached to this so that we could record the vocalizations as those hatchlings are moving about in their environment. And this was something that I had gone to Japan last summer to work with some of the robotics researchers over there. And we helped they helped me to develop this kind of base model, which I've just recently tested out, and I'm looking forward to getting a few students at Carthage on a turtle robot project soon.
Yeah, right. So where exactly are you in the process of developing this robot?
Right. I have the base model, so I've already tested out the navigation ability of the turtle robot, and the next step is to be able to attach a hydrophone and track that actual turtle. So we haven't worked with any of the turtles yet, only been working on the robot end of things. But now that that's up and running, the next step will be to get permission to work with turtles.
Wow. So exactly how do you envision deploying this robot? I mean, what would the setting be, and where would the robot be in relationship to the turtle and the turtle nest specifically? I mean, kind of logistically and geographically,
right?
How would this likely work?
Logistically, what's going to have to happen is we're going to have to find a viable nest of turtles, wait for them to hatch. On that hatching day, we'd pick up each of these turtles, put a pit tag in them. These are just little chips that, can be inserted into the turtles. And then once we release the turtles into the pond or, river, we'd release the robot with it. And one of my students will have to be out with that robot tracking the turtle manually. Ideally, we're going to get this to a point where the turtle can work autonomously and just go after the hatchlings and, send us all the data through satellite transmitters, but at this point we're nowhere near
right,
that part of it. That's, that's much further down the road.
Right, exactly. So the robot will be following a turtle or all of the turtles?
Turtle. Nope. Okay. It'll follow a single turtle. And it's quite likely that the hatchlings actually will be fairly near one another so that the robot could pick up frequency tags from multiple individuals, but we just don't know. I mean,
right.
We have no idea where they're going or what they do.
Right.
So,
and then will there be one robot deployed per turtle nest?
Right now, yes, it'll just be one robot per turtle until we get some of the logistics worked out on tracking them.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, part of what ultimately will be part of this research is to also explore a bit more of the vocalization of these particular turtles. Where are we right now in terms of what we know and don't know about the vocalization of these turtles?
Right now, so the turtles that I'm most interested in, working with are snapping turtles. Just always enjoyed working with them. It's a fun species to handle.
If you're careful.
If you're careful, yes. Please don't go handling turtles if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah,
but if you've been trained on how to handle turtles, they actually are really a fun species to work with. So I'd like to start with those snapping turtles. And right now, we don't know anything about the turtle vocalizations or the vocalizations that species is producing. So this
we know they vocalize?
We suspect that they vocalize.
Oh, okay.
There's been a few studies started on looking at freshwater turtles in Wisconsin. Nothing published yet, but Blanding's turtles and snapping turtles are two of the species that we believe do actually vocalize. So.
So this work with this robot, in a sense, takes you back to your roots, takes you back to 2006 when you first became really fascinated with animal vocalization.
It certainly does, yes. So this has been kind of fun to be able to bring that back around again.
Terrific. For those of you just joining us, my guest today on The Morning Show is Dr. Angela Dussault, who is a professor, assistant professor of biology at Carthage College, and she is especially interested in the vocalization of animals, and it's three different species that she has worked with primarily. We've just been talking about turtles, and I want to spend a few minutes returning to the white-handed gibbon. How did you first become interested in this particular species and their vocalization?
Right. So there's so many different species that we can choose from when looking at bioacoustic studies. And I ultimately went with the white-handed gibbon for a couple of reasons. One is the first time I heard a white-handed gibbon, I was really quite amazed at the diversity of sounds that they make. Darwin actually even wrote about them, about how they have a singing voice. And they really, truly do have this amazing range of sounds that they can produce. And so I was somewhat personally interested in the species, but I also had met a researcher who had been recording gibbons in the wild, and she was willing to share all of her recordings with me. So I had this large corpus of vocalizations to already get started with. So I really only had to record gibbons in captivity yet, which was quite helpful for a comparison. And it turned out very well because not only was able to identify 28 different types of sounds that those white-handed gibbons make, but then we were able to follow it up to find out that they have both what's considered motivational and referential content. And what that means is that for motivational types of sounds, this is an excited utterance. So if somebody startles you and you gasp, that would be a motivational sound. Whereas a referential sound would be more of a word. And so the gibbons that I was working with, we presented them with different predator models. So they had this clouded leopard. They had a tiger skin, which was actually it's a tiger rug that was draped over a very eager undergraduate student who was willing to participate in this. Then the snake model. And the way that the study was conducted is that for each of the different gibbon groups, one of these predator models was placed out in the forest floor for 20 minutes. And the gibbons, once they saw the predator model, they started vocalizing. Those were recorded. And then we ultimately went through and sequenced each of the different sounds that they were making to compare each of the different responses. And gibbons are a really interesting group to work with because these are female-led groups. So they're territorial. They live in small family units, so usually only 3 to 5 individuals per territory. But it's always led by the adult female. And she just produces this beautiful sequence called a great call, followed by her male partner producing a coda. And these are their territorial singing bouts.
So I assume that when you are listening to these sounds, it is probably as much as anything what you see on the screen that helps you differentiate between this call and that call and so on.
Some bioacoustics researchers like to use the visual displays. I actually do prefer the auditory.
Oh, really?
Yes, I find it easier to listen than to visualize.
Or look at patterns on a screen.
Right.
So evidently then these various calls from the gibbons must be distinct enough that just from hearing them, you can differentiate between them.
Right. That's actually, it's funny. My grad school advisor and I disagree on this point where he preferred the visual. Hughes and I prefer the auditory ones and disagreed that they are acoustically distinct enough to hear. But then as we started to run through the statistical analysis and clustered all of the different sound units, you realize that, no, I actually do have very good hearing.
this is
a perfectly fine way to differentiate. So it's really just a personal preference when working with these kinds of sounds.
One of the things that occurs to me is for you as a scientist, who's also a human being. I mean, scientists are human beings, but let me explain what I mean by that. I should think that the side of you that's just a person wants to find these exciting developments. I mean, like you want there to be these distinct calls that really mean something and so on. And I'm just curious about that versus the scientist with just cold, hard data where you need to stick to exactly the data itself and not wish certain things into being. You know what I'm getting at?
I know exactly.
Can you just talk for a moment about the meticulous care that a scientist must take in order to make sure that the discoveries that they're making are of phenomena that are really there.
Right. Yes. As a scientist, it is easy to anthropomorphize and project our own feelings, particularly when working with apes. Maybe not so much turtles for a lot of people, but for apes, right?
Right. There's something very exciting, very enticing about them being like us in some sort of way. And I should think the temptation would be there, and especially a scientist who's not being careful with his or her research could really make some mistakes.
Right. It is, though, with bioacoustics work, there's so much time in between when we record and actually work with the animals versus when those recordings are fully analyzed and then annotated and published that I find that separation is certainly enough. So for instance, I was recording the gibbons at the Racine Zoo in 2012, but I didn't really finish the analysis until the end of 2013. So I had this really large window of time where I could forget a little bit of what each individual is doing that day, and I could look at just the data that I was measuring. Mm,
that makes a big difference.
And that really, it does help a lot. Mm. Yes.
And just to return to the fascinating points you were making earlier, that what we're talking about with these white-handed gibbons is that they vocalize very specifically according to whatever threat is perceived. So what exactly are you keeping track of as you track that kind of thing? I mean, for instance, how is your data laid out to make it clear that so-and-so came in the cage at this point and they made such-and-such a sound? I mean, how do you keep track of all that?
Right. So there's a couple of things to keep track of. One, we need to keep track of the sounds that each individual in the group is making because they're vocalizing at the same time. So you can have up to five individuals calling at the same time for the same predator.
Right. So, and we've all been past a cage where we've heard this cacophony
right,
of sounds. And,
right.
Right. Interesting.
So that has to be kept separate from one another. But then once those individuals are identified, then it's about looking at each individual sound and the sequence that those sounds are produced in. So what is the probability of going from, let's say, sound A to sound B in a given predator context?
Right.
And then it just gets expanded into all 28 of their sounds. What is the probability between each of these individual sound units pairing up or tripling up? And so I ultimately ended up identifying the first couple thousand sounds that each individual made and then looked at all of the probabilities between each individual sound and each gibbon.
Wow.
And came up with what is considered, I think, a word in gibbon.
Interesting.
Yes, and it they really do have very distinct sequences for their clouded leopard predator, for tiger, and for the snake. And the tiger was particularly interesting because we had two different scenarios set up where there was either a tiger that was sitting or a tiger that was moving.
Mm.
And the gibbons have different word-like structures for a moving tiger versus a sitting tiger.
Wow.
So that you can even differentiate at that level.
Wow. So there's a lot of thought process going
on in the
brain of that white-handed gibbon.
Right.
And when it comes to listening to the sounds and differentiating the sounds, I assume that you are exploring some of the most basic building blocks of sound, like pitch and duration and loudness, that kind of thing.
Yes. So entropy, a lot of the frequency measurements are important, particularly with gibbons. So for other species, frequency isn't necessarily as important. So things like toads, they produce these different trills. We only have one toad in Wisconsin, so when you hear a toad, it's always the American toad. Mm. But in other parts of the world, there's multiple species, and all of the toads make these trills that are pretty much all in the same frequency range, but they vary in the rate. So the number of sounds per minute is important. So it really is kind of taxa dependent. But yes, for gibbons, a lot of the pitch and amplitude measurements are important.
Right. Fascinating. Mm-hmm. And now we finally get to your work with the gray wolf, which has been also a really significant part of the work that you have been doing. So tell us when you began working with the sounds of the gray wolf.
So this actually technically does go back to when I was in high school.
Oh.
And started with the wolf trapping and tracking. Part of the way that we follow wolves or know how many individuals are in an area is to do howl surveys. So I was fortunate enough to be able to learn how to go out and howl to wolves at night. It's actually much more effective to have a person go out and howl than it is to play back a recording of a wolf howling.
Hmm.
They can tell that recording is not a real wolf howling, and they have a tendency not to respond. But when a human goes out and howls, they will howl back. And so I actually started this in high school, but then, as I said, moved on to a lot of other interesting projects in between. And we came back around to it this past summer because the Summer Undergraduate Research Experience, or SURE program, at Carthage allows researchers, students to work with us as researchers and learn a little bit about, you know, how do we conduct these different studies. So I took two biology students with me, Kara Hall and Caitlin McComb, and taught them some of the basics on how we analyze sounds, and then took them up to central Wisconsin for a month, and we went out and recorded wolves every single night, which is really an exciting time because you're out at night, don't have any flashlights because that can deter any animals from calling. So you're out in the pitch darkness, and you're calling these wolves in. We want to get as close as we possibly can to wolves at night.
Yeah, some people would say that's a little bit nuts, but
Some people would.
But I can see how for other people that would just be as exciting as life gets. Incredible. Now, when you are making these sounds, are you trying to imitate the howl of a wolf as closely as possible, or is it okay that you're a human being howling in the way that a human being would howl?
Right. We try to get as close to a wolf howl as possible, and actually we with a little bit of practice, you can get pretty good howls out of humans. And that was actually one of the skills that Kara and Caitlin both had to pick up. They practiced their howls, and they did a wonderful job. They were able to get wolves to howl back to us just about every single night.
Wow. Now, my understanding is the primary work that you've done with the gray wolf is in the matter of individual identification, that is, each wolf having their own specific sort of howl or certain details in their own howl that make it unique, make it distinct from the howls of their fellow wolves. Am I remembering that correctly?
That is correct, yes. So the idea behind this project wasn't so much to learn what the howls mean, but rather how those howls are different from one individual to the next. So the reason that we would want to know individuals by their voice is because that would offer conservation biologists a way of tracking individuals without having to actually trap them. Mm. Wolf trapping has been going on for decades. It's a very effective way of monitoring populations, but it's costly and it's very time consuming. So you have to track where the populations are. Setting the traps is not an easy task.
Right.
And then effectively trapping them is pretty challenging as well. And once you do have the wolf in the trap, then you have an angry wolf in your trap that you have to deal with.
Right,
And so it's all around, it would be beneficial if for certain studies, if all you want to know is, you know, who's in this area at what time, where are they dispersing to, those kinds of studies you could easily be done through vocalizations, assuming we could identify individuals based on their voice. And what we discovered is that, in fact, you certainly can, even in very low quality recordings. We had an idea that it probably was going to be successful. Some of our colleagues had actually already done this in captivity, where you get the microphones really close to the wolves, and we get really nice recordings. But we wanted to see whether or not after we are out in the wild, there's a little bit more noise, the sounds are traveling further distances, which means they degrade, they don't sound quite as good as what they do in captivity, whether that was actually something that would be persistent enough to be used. And as it turns out, yes, we can absolutely identify individuals.
Wow. What would be some of the most important markers, I mean, that would differentiate the howl of wolf A versus wolf B?
Right. So we found that there were two key frequency measurements. So these are kind of a pitch measurements. And that's the frequency at the very end of the howl. So right as they're kind of trailing off at the end, that measurement at that timestamp, and then the maximum frequency of that howl. So whatever the highest frequency is. Those two features combined can tell individuals apart from one another.
I was just comparing this to human beings, that probably what differentiates, let's say, two men or from each other, or two women from each other, as much as anything, will be timbre, tone color, and the fact that every human being really has a very unique voice to themselves. And you know, for instance, in my line of work, when I'm listening to singers, I immediately know who somebody is just from the tone color.
Right.
But I suspect when we're in the animal kingdom that that's probably not something that is going to be nearly so distinct from being to being.
Right. That one really hasn't been used quite as often in bioacoustic studies. And that's not necessarily to say that it couldn't be useful, but we've just found success in some of these other
sure.
measurements.
Well, and I should think that timbre is something very difficult to quantify.
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't know the first way to. I mean, certainly the difference between the typical human male voice and female voice is distinct with all kinds of differences of pitch. But when we're talking about tone color, how you attach some kind of number or other really specific marker, that's probably a whole different thing than, for instance, frequency.
Right.
That's numerically very clear and straightforward.
Yes. And that gets us back to, got to keep numbers in this so that we aren't projecting our own biases on our animals.
Yeah. So this is a project that's currently underway?
We've pretty much wrapped up this first series of recordings and analysis, and have already sent in a manuscript for peer review. And the next stage of this would be to actually record in that same population and see whether the pups from last year are still around and whether we can identify those voices really as they change. Just like with humans, as you grow up from child to adult, your voice changes.
Right.
And that happens with wolves as well. So tracking whether those younger individuals can still be identified as they're a year older now would be really our next step here.
Fascinating.
Yes.
And of course, the other thing is getting back to, for instance, what you discovered with the gibbon is that in certain cases, wolves are perhaps making sounds under different circumstances. Although I suspect that this howling that we're talking about, tends not to be in response to anything real specific in the environment. But nevertheless, is that a complicating factor?
That can be a complicating factor, certainly. There's some research going on right now, a researcher in Cambridge who is actually analyzing the differences between howl meaning and wolves also produce some barks. Mm. And so looking at, you know, what that actually correlates with.
Yeah.
So yes, there's certainly some exciting work being done there as well.
Yeah. So do you think about other kinds of animals that you have not yet studied in this particular field that you hope at some point to maybe begin studying?
I would actually like to study all of the gibbons. So there's 16 different species of gibbons, and each one has its own vocal repertoire. So I've only worked with the one species so far, but I think it would be really interesting to not only compare the evolution of the different gibbon vocalizations, but also within my own population of gibbons, looking at whether there's dialectical variation. So there's 5 different subpopulations of the species that I work with, and it has actually been demonstrated in other species of primates that there is some dialectical variation in Campbell's monkeys in particular, but I suspect that that's going to be possible to find in gibbons as well.
Wow.
And that's actually going to be part of the focus of a documentary that I'm putting together right now. So we're going to be hopefully traveling to Thailand at the end of the year here to record in the wild. And
wow.
Yes.
Well, I suppose one of the interesting questions is whether or not different species of gibbons, is there any potential for them to be able to, in a sense, talk to one another? Or is that sense of specific dialects means that it's almost like different languages being spoken?
Yeah, there is actually some evidence already that the different species of gibbons do understand the other species' vocalizations, particularly the one of the groups of gibbons that I work with in Thailand. There's another species of gibbon, the pileated gibbon, that joins this group every once in a while and sings during some of the territory calls. She's singing in her own, of course, vocal repertoire, but it mirrors the vocal repertoire of the white-handed gibbon. Mm. So I think that it is actually possible. Why they're getting together, I don't know.
Incredible. Well, there is no shortage of fascinating questions, and you are in the wonderful business of finding answers to some of these intriguing questions about why animals make the sounds that they do. And this has been just endlessly fascinating, and I'm so glad to have you here to talk about this work. And as your work goes on from here, I hope we'll get to have more morning show conversations in the future.
I would love that.
Dr. Angela Desso, Assistant Professor of Biology at Carthage College. Great to have you here. Thank you so much for making time for this.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I'm replaying out of the archives my conversation with author Tim Madigan, the author of a book called I'm Proud of You, My Friendship with Fred Rogers. As maybe you know, there is a wonderful documentary film in some movie theaters right now called Won't You Be My Neighbor, which looks back at the extraordinary legacy of Fred Rogers. And so I want to replay this conversation from about a decade ago with Tim Madigan, who, quite by accident actually, came to meet Fred Rogers, and the two of them became very close friends. And